This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Mike, are you going soft?
No.
What do you think, Adam?
A little.
And not because you're my boss and you also.
And you have a lot of bosses.
I do have a lot of bosses, and I just criticized both of them.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Miami Heat of Education Policy, Adam Emerson.
Good afternoon, Mike. It's great to be here.
You are unbeatable.
Unbeatable.
Just like the Heat. They're on quite a streak as we're talking here. I saw something like, what is it? Something like 14 games in a row, something crazy like that?
Yeah, they're the super team.
And so it does not. It's going to be tough for somebody. Not only has to beat them once, they would have to beat them four times in order to actually take a series from them and keep them from winning the championship.
They're the new dynasty.
Yes, and I guess there's poor fans in Cleveland, in our home state of Ohio. Let's see their star go to the Miami Heat, and he's as good as they said he was.
Yes, he's as good as they said he was, and they still hate him just as much as when he left.
LeBron, wow. Okay, well, you know, hey, these things happen. These things go in cycles. Eventually, there'll be a new LeBron, and somebody might knock him off the pedestal.
Yeah, it was Jordan, now it's LeBron, and it'll take another 20 years. You'll see the next one.
All right. Hey, lots to cover in this week's Education Gadfly Show. Things happening on the education reform front. We have a special treat for everyone today. Pamela, unfortunately, her voice is not quite up to the task, so producer Joe will be joining us for Pardon the Gadfly. Joe, kick us off.
In the Atlantic and in this week's Gadfly, Checker argues that private schools are dying out. Why is this happening, and can we do anything about it?
And Adam, does Joe have a great radio voice?
He has an awesome radio voice.
Yeah, he does.
Pamela has competition.
He does. Oh, she's kicking Amber. He's kicking Adam under the table. Okay, so here's the question: why are private schools dying out? Checker says, look, they're becoming unaffordable. Like private colleges are becoming unaffordable. They're facing competition from technology. Gentrification. By the way, I gave Checker this idea. Gentrification is an issue because it used to be you could live in some cities
and still afford a private school.
At a discount because your house wouldn't cost that much money, and then you could still afford private school. Well, now in a place like DC, you're going to pay a premium to live in the city, plus afford private school. That's tough to take. So what do you think, Adam? Is there anything that can be done? Are private schools just perpetually on the way out?
I think he's got some very provocative points. I think he has some very good points. And it's not just the unaffordability. It's not
And it's not just that he's the president of the foundation.
It's not just that he's president of the foundation. It's not just that he's my boss, but he's got a point as far as not only being unaffordable, but his more provocative point is it's becoming more unnecessary. What you are getting out in the suburbs of some very good private schools or some very good public schools that don't look all that different from private schools these days. So what is really differentiating the private sector and the public sector? Provocative points that a lot of folks in the private education industry don't necessarily want to point out, but I think it's a good point when you see the big mix of the public sector today.
So. All right. So basically, what does differentiate still is on religion. Right, that
biggest
many of these private
biggest
schools
that he's talking about,
are religious, or at that high end, when you're talking about the $30,000 schools, the Sidwell Friends,
the Sidwell Friends are going to be fine.
Those are differentiated, but they're doing okay. But it's the religious schools, and Checker points out, look, in other countries, including in Europe, that we look as being sort of our liberal neighbors across the ocean, you know, they see no problem with funding private schools, including religious schools, with public dollars. They've been doing that forever. And as long as parents have a choice between different kinds of schools, they don't particularly have a hang up with church and state.
Of course,
you know, some of them used to have state religions, and so there's a like historical, you know,
very established.
They just haven't really been so touchy about that issue all along. Granted, you know, the pilgrims left England for that reason, blah, 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 blah. But still, point being, you could have a system where you supported these schools using public dollars. Why don't we do that here?
Well, it's tricky because you got to get around Blaine amendments and compel support clauses. So we've developed vouchers and tax credit scholarships, but those sectors aren't taking off that fast. I mean, we've seen growth, but growth is very slow. And given the challenges facing the private education sector today, that's largely a stopgap measure. So, I mean, there has to be something much more transformational happening to keep the private education well-sustained. And I think we ought to. This is where I think he gets a little too pessimistic. We can find ways to sort of turn this around.
Look, is it charter schools? I mean, people say, look, these are quasi-private schools. They're free. Of course, they're going to put private schools out of business.
Yeah, it's partly
charter schools. Certainly a lot of Catholic folks think that. I was at the AFC conference this week where they still have a lot of ambivalence and a little bit of anger at the growth of the charter sector on their behalf. But I don't think you can blame it all on that. I mean, it's a part of it. It's one component of it. But even as our own Kathleen Porter McGee has written here, Catholic schools had some troubles long before charter schools came into the mix, too.
Topic number two, Joe.
On Deborah Meyer's Bridging Differences blog this week, Mike, you argued that the charter school movement erred in agreeing to take part in statewide accountability systems. Mike, are you going soft?
No.
What do you think, Adam?
A little.
And not well because said. You're my boss and you also.
But well said. Adam, you have a lot of bosses.
I do have a lot of bosses, and I've just criticized both of them.
Okay, good.
I don't think you're getting soft. I think there's some good points here. And if I'm getting your position right, what you're looking at is, hey, let's get back to some of the first principles that we have of chartering. I mean, what basically differentiated them, but apply the lessons we've learned over the last 20 years, where we've seen a lot of bad apples surface, but figure out a way how to get away from some of the more uniform standards back into some of the more results-oriented accountability that they think could work best for their own programs.
Well, look, what I argue in the piece is I say this. I say it used to be at the beginning of the movement, we talked about customized charters, contracts for each school, and the school would say, here are the results we promised to get.
Yep.
Certainly, almost always would include test scores, but could include lots of other things as well, and would be customized to the educational vision of the school. That was, I think, generally a smart approach. Then along came testing and accountability after many of those charter schools were started. And what we kind of made a deal with the devil. We said, okay, we will apply these same accountability systems to charter schools too, because they are public schools, and because we would have been crucified if we had tried to make the case that charters deserve something different. Well, what does that mean? It means that charters, like everybody else, are basically now just held accountable for the test scores. And I think that there are some set of charter schools and traditional public schools out there that may look not so great by traditional measures of test scores, but could show impressive results using other kinds of data, like, hey, our students go on to attend college at high rates. They graduate from college at high rates. You know, they beat the odds in other ways. You know, these short-term measures of test scores don't look great, but look at the long-term measures. And all I'm saying is, look, we should have a system where charters or district schools can opt out of statewide accountability systems and opt in to something just as rigorous, but into a different set of measures that they could negotiate. My own sense is that at the end, it's going to be a fairly small group of schools that would choose to do it if you make it rigorous enough. It might include inspections. It might include long-term measures. This is not a way to let bad schools off the hook. It's a way to let great schools show their stuff in other ways and to try to deal with this concern that the testing is driving schools to do things that they that are not educationally sound.
No, I think all great ideas, and I agree, it's probably going to be a small group, but and it's absolutely important to re-examine how our accountability systems are working. There's nothing wrong with taking a look at it and seeing where we have been led astray on that. But we've also learned a lot about how strong authorizers play a role into all this. And I think your ideas are good as long as we have good authorizers and a good authorizing environment in place to keep a lot of that in check. I mean, who's going to be judging a lot of those accountability measures that come down the line? I wouldn't want to trust just any authorizer to take a look at that. So I think that's important to have in place for that to work. But I do think it can work.
Okay. So in conclusion, Adam agrees with me. Okay. Topic number three.
Chiefs for Change is pushing back against calls for a moratorium on the stakes attached to standardized tests, stressing the importance of maintaining accountability. Do they have a point?
They have a point, but let me push back against Chiefs for Change. Look, I'm psyched to see Chiefs for Change out there strong on Common Core. These are, by and large, chiefs operating in red states under Republican administrations, not all of them, but many of them. And there's a lot of pressure, as we know, to dump the Common Core. They're standing fast. They are pushing back against Randy Weingarten's call for a moratorium on high stakes. And I, my own view, and I'm still kind of looking at this issue, I think that when it comes to teacher evaluations, there's got to be some kind of pause or I mean, it is not fair to tell teachers, look, we want you to teach these new standards. We want you to try new things and they're going to be harder to teach. And by the way, we're going to chop your head off if you don't do it well. Mm-hmm. So I think that's fair. School accountability, I could, you know, take it or leave it. We could probably keep going with that. There's going to have to be some kind of adjustment for going from an easy test to a bad test. But I think on teacher evaluations, I don't know. I mean, look, I don't think teacher evaluations valuations are worth a hill of beans anyways, but what's your take, Adam?
Well, I mean, you know, and Chucker was on the show a couple weeks ago making a similar point. And as far as teacher evaluations go, there's nothing wrong with hitting the pause button, especially on that, especially at least rethinking how this is going to work, given we've seen so many clumsy attempts at trying to implement this in some states. But the word moratorium has it with it some really bad connotations that I think Chiefs for Change was right to call out here. I mean, it makes it sound like, you know, moratorium is we're ready to dump this thing out altogether eventually, mm-hmm. After a lot of politicking along the way. So, no, it's pause, yes, moratorium, they're right to call them out on.
Boom. Nicely said, Adam. Okay, thank you, Joe. Thanks for helping us there with Pardon the Gadfly. Your radio voice may be called upon again on another date. Pamela, you better, you know, all I'm saying is next time you really got to step it up a little bit once your voice comes back. Okay, it is now time for everyone's favorite, a woman who steps it up every single week, Amber Winkler's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Amber, we haven't talked about it yet, but hard week in Oklahoma.
Oh, it's terrible. I mean, I think all of our hearts are heavy. You know, I don't think we knew it was going to be as terrible as it was.
I mean, to have schools hit is just everybody's nightmare. It does. It really hits me now, mm-hmm. being a parent. You too, I'm sure.
Right.
Adam, Amber, I understand you were sitting next to Oklahoma's state superintendent when the storm blew through
just
Oklahoma.
Just really heartbreaking. I mean, she was watching on her phone, you know, and we were just looking at it. And just to know these are your students, you know, in your schools being impacted by this, was
you were at a meeting in D.C., and I understand she obviously stood up and left.
She had to leave, understandably. So
toward the damage the next day, it's just hard. So our thoughts and prayers for everybody in Oklahoma. Did you used to do tornado drills when you were a teacher?
You know, we had maybe a couple tornado drills, as I recall. Yeah, we did, but not a lot.
Fire drills.
Yeah.
More.
Yeah, more fire drills. But, I mean, I think it was like, you know, in case of a tornado, do, you know, roll up tighter or something. Right. It wasn't anything.
Well,
that's
I was always, it's always hard. You always forget. You're like, okay, wait, which one is for tornadoes? Potato. Which one's for the fire? Which one's for the terrorism? Which one's the, you know?
Yeah, we didn't have the terrorism. I'm dating myself now. But
yeah. All right. So what do you have for us
this week? We have a new report out by McKinsey this week. It's called Voice of the Graduate, surveyed about 4,900 two- and four-year recent college grads. On a number of topics, mostly about preparedness and job satisfaction. I have qualms about the survey design. I will not get into the weeds on that. But anyway, it's not exactly representative, although they tried to weight it. Yeah. Top five findings. Almost half of graduates from four-year colleges say they're in jobs that don't require a four-year degree. Graduates in STEM subjects, however, are more likely to report being in jobs that do require a four-year degree. Mm-hmm. A third of graduates of four-year colleges also report that college did not prepare them for employment. A little over a third at both two- and four-year colleges say they would choose a different college if they could do it all over again.
A third?
A third. No. A little over a third.
Okay.
A third say they would choose a different major. Students majoring in visual and performing arts, language, literature, and social sciences are most likely to wish they'd majored in something else.
I'm shocked.
You want to know the major that's least likely to question their original choice?
Mm-hmm. This is computer science?
Chemical engineering.
Health majors. What kind of jobs are health majors getting? I don't know, but they're getting jobs.
The healthcare system, there's a lot of jobs out there.
Yeah. I mean, I guess they're getting a lot. Is it Obamacare? Anyway, I'll go on. 41% of graduates from the top 100 universities, according to U.S. News and World Reports, report not being employed in the field they'd hope to enter. Percentage is 48% for everyone else not in a top flag university, so it's not a huge difference between the top tier and the not top tier. The retail and restaurant industries were among the least desired fields for students entering or attending all types of institutions, but they end up employing 4 to 5 times the number of graduates who report they want to work in those fields.
Starbucks.
And finally, liberal arts grads at four-year colleges fare worse than average across most measures. They're lower paid, they're less likely to be employed full-time, they're less prepared for the workforce. The findings for business majors and STEM majors, on the other hand, are more positive for those same majors. Woo!
So, of course, the question here is this education or is this simply a really bad economy? Right?
That's right.
I mean, look, I mean, this is happening, yeah. you know, in the shadow of the Great Recession.
Yeah,
we are still in a jobs recession.
2012 was when they graduated.
This is the most underemployed young generation ever.
It's tough. You know, the hard thing for these folks is that a lot of evidence will show that they will never catch up in terms of pay and other things. That when you are unlucky to be born in the middle of a recession, you just never make up those differences compared to other age cohorts that, you know, you struggle to find work. Eventually, you know, let's assume a couple years from now, employment comes back down to normal. They'll move into other jobs, but they will have just lost those key years of the fast earnings that tends to happen.
Well, just earning power and savings. I mean, all the factors that are going to be required for them just to catch up. I mean, a few years ago, the Wall Street Journal said it was going to take them 10 years. Now, God, you're right. I mean, will they ever be able to catch up to where we were?
Yeah. Then again, you know, I mean, I graduated college in the mid-90s, just at, you know, kind of the end of the early 90s recession, and this was back in the days of Reality Bites and the Slackers and everything else. Right. And then all my friends went on to make $1 billion in, you know, internet startups. So that Tumblr kid. What is he? He's like in eighth grade worth $1 billion.
He looks like, seriously, I saw him on a morning talk show. How old is that kid?
How old is he? 23. He's not 23, Joe, is he? He does not look 23.
Mm-hmm. He doesn't look 23. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things these guys say in the report is we need to do a better job telling kids, you know, employment trajectories and trends and good majors. And I just don't know whether that is the answer or not. I mean, you can tell a kid, hey, you're going to make not a lot of money if you major in this major. But kids, I just don't know if that's what motivates them, you know? They kind of want to do what they want to do.
We also got to take the long view here, right? Most of these kids are going to live till they're 100 years old, right? Maybe more, depending on technology. I mean, let's pace ourselves. Here, people. I mean, let's see how things look 10 years from now. The economy comes back. And, you know, especially, look, I am partial to liberal arts majors. I mean, I think that there's a lot of benefit from having people major in the liberal arts and get that broad background. And we know that people have never done well coming right out of college with just liberal arts. But look, once they get some experience, once they go to grad school, then they usually will do okay. And anyways,
how much does grad school cost now? I mean, golly, these poor kids are already going to have all this debt. They can't find a job. And now we're telling them to get more school.
I have noticed that the baristas are quite skilled and literate.
Literate. I mean,
and the BLS,
very well read.
This was not in this survey, but the BLS survey basically said that more waitresses and taxi cab drivers have college degrees now than even 10 or 15 years ago. I mean, the percentage just keeps going up in terms of these service sector industries and how many of them are college educated.
Well, I'm still trying to figure out why kids are still going into journalism school. That's the only question I have.
That's a good question.
You can write, though. I mean, at least around here, writing's pretty highly skilled trade that we really value. So,
all right, we certainly value it here at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute.
Yeah,
all right, thank you, Amber. That is all the time we've got for the show. Till next week.
I am Adam Emerson,
and I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show. Signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.